Welcome to Panini Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. Now, this, of course, is our Sondheim adjacent episode. This is what we do each and every month. Thank you so much to the people over on Patreon for supporting the show. It allows us to do some extra bonus things here. And today, I'm very excited because this is actually a true Sondheim adjacent project that we're talking about here this month, which is Lady Bird.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom,
you should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Lady Bird, is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quotes?
I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Lady Bird always says that she lives on the wrong side of the tracks, but I always thought that that was like a metaphor. But there are actual train tracks.
What she did was very baller. It was very anarchist.
Put the magazine back!
And I thought I would bring on a new guest, Sam Harriman. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Kyle. It's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast.
Now, before we jump into talking about this movie, what makes you an expert of talking about film?
Well, I have a very expensive piece of paper, which does, I guess, confer on me that I am a master of screenwriting from a film school in Australia. So I guess that theoretically makes me an expert of talking about film. But no, I'm a student. At the moment, I'm a PhD student working on linguistics and screenwriting, so looking at the language of screenplays and in Australian Aboriginal English and how that is represented by screenwriters in screenplays. So that's kind of my there. So got my bachelor's in media communications, working on representations of transgender characters in screenplays. Then got on to a master's of screenwriting, and now I'm sort of completing the set, looking at the linguistics of screenwriting. So with all of that, I've kind of had a lot of work in film studies as well throughout those degrees. And I'm, I guess, a freelance writer as well in my spare time when I can do it. So I wrote a couple of films in film school, and that were great experiences and taught me a lot about collaboration and creativity and sort of how the sausage gets made and why I love filmmaking. So yeah, it's been a long journey for me, but screenwriting has always been at the heart of it and exploring what it is about movies that make them tick, really.
I think that's super fascinating. Like, I'm assuming then that you, having gone through all your studies, what have you noticed about the changes, say, if we look at the totality of the movie industry, like how were scripts written differently, say, in the 50s versus what they are now in like the 2020s?
I mean, certainly early on, and if we're talking about the Hollywood system, it was a real industry and they had multiple writers working on projects and it was more of a blueprint for the director to sort of come in. And it was all there in the script, not the shots, but, you know, very clearly, this is what we're shooting and this is how we're going to shoot it. And directors didn't really like that. And there were all these rules in place about how, you know, you can't change what's on the page and you just shoot it as written. And so the big change in the 60s and 70s was the directors starting to take control back and writing their own films. And scripts took a really different sort of form there outside of the Hollywood system. And then I think at the moment, we're sort of seeing a little bit of a byplay. There's always new ways of writing scripts and new scripting practices, especially amongst independent films where, you know, you might just have a sketch of a scene and you go out and you shoot that. And the dialogue is often quite improvised, especially in some of the more indie films like Jim Jarmusch often does a lot of that stuff. And I think there's more flexibility now in terms of how you can write a script and what you can do with the words on the page. The script to A Quiet Place is very creative in the way that it uses the actual format of the screenplay, a big black page, I think, at one point, and like totally blank except for the word bang or something. Like it's a really way. And I think that's for spec scripts, you know, for amateur screenwriters to get noticed. Sometimes you do have to do something a little bit different because there's so many screenplays that are being written all the time. And generally, they're all pretty good. So it's about what is it that can make your work pop and stand out. But that's very different to a script like Lady Bird, which is written and directed by the same person because you don't have to pass that on to anybody. So you're writing a document really for yourself and for some of the other crew as well, but it doesn't have to be perfectly written to make sure that your vision is intact because it's your vision that you're carrying on from writing to directing it and then sitting in the edit room as well.
Before we jump into talking about the actual movie we're here to talk about, you've just untapped some fascinating things in my head. So because you have focused, like you said, on in Australia, specifically with, you said, like Aboriginal tales, like what are some of those films that you're talking about?
Not to bore you with a long history of Australia, but pre-contact, pre-colonization, there was...
All the prisoners came there first, right?
Yeah. So pre-prisoners, there was an incredible linguistic diversity. Actually, not dissimilar to Canada, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I wanted
to bring that up, actually, honestly. Like, us both being, you know, colonies of Britain, there are some similarities. Having watched a lot of Canadian film, and I've seen a fair amount of Australian film as well, there is interesting similarities I keep picking out.
Yeah, well, I think Canada and Australia are actually probably the two most similar of the sort of modern-day Commonwealth countries, because we didn't have to fight independence. We were just, we asked for it and were given it. And I think that creates a real, an interesting relationship. Well, New Zealand a little bit, but the Maori population is quite different to Australian, Canadian. So yeah, pre-contact, incredible linguistic diversity. I think it was over 500 or 600 distinct languages, and then variation that was spoken, handed down by generation. And at the moment, there's only, I think, 10 mostly spoken in the north of Australia, northwest. So most Aboriginal people, most Indigenous Australians speak English as their first language. And what I'm looking at is what we call Aboriginal English or Aboriginal English as, which is the ways that Aboriginal people use English in contemporary society as a way of sort of creating community amongst themselves. And so there's probably more films, especially in the early days, that show Indigenous languages, and that's very important. It's not necessarily what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at is the way that the variety of English that we call Aboriginal English is represented in film and television. I'm mostly looking at TV shows. So there's a show called Mystery Road, which is based on a film by Ivan Sen. Mystery Goldstone, sort of like a pseudo-Western crime detective. Like he's a detective with the police force, and he goes in and does a drug bust and stuff. And there's interesting parallels or interesting sort of intersections within Aboriginal society, because they're often in remote towns that he goes and investigates his crimes in. Detective Jay Swan, he's sort of like an ongoing character now. They just did an origin series where he's played by a much younger actor, and reveals everything about how he got to be where he's going to be. And there's a show called The Warriors, which I don't think that was shown anywhere outside of Australia, actually, but it's just a sports comedy drama, again, with some really interesting commentaries on language. It's a very sort of Aboriginal English is up front and center in a few of those episodes. That's a really good case study to see the attitudes and ideologies that are represented in the screenplays around Aboriginal English. But there's lots of films being made now that sort of really center the Indigenous experience, made by Indigenous filmmakers, which is great. There was a film that just premiered at TIFF, actually, called Sweet As by Jump Clerk, and that's another coming of age. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very, very keen to see that one. It's about a young Indigenous girl who goes on camp, I think, a photography camp. And it's the sort of genre that I'm really interested in, and it's always good to see different perspectives. So keep an eye out for that one when it comes to cinemas.
To make this connection, is your fascination, I guess, with language part of why you like Stephen Sondheim?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think to a T. I mean, there's no one who's more precise with language, I think, in any form than Stephen is. By going back to the start, like, my musical journey started in earnest with Lane Hits. And I think that was purely music based. I always call it, that was my gateway to Sondheim, because I just loved that production so much and loved the music of it. But then as soon as I saw
Was that album, or did you see one of like the concert versions?
I had the 25th anniversary on like DVD or something. The one with like Matt Lucas.
Here we go. Charging for the lice, extra for the mice. 2% for looking in the mirror twice. There a little slice, there a little cut. 3% for sleeping with the window shut. When it comes to fixing prices, there are lots of tricks he knows. How it all increases, all the bits and pieces. Jesus, it's amazing how it grows.
And I just, I don't know, there was something about it. It was like so grand and wonderful. But then as soon as I saw the pro shot of Into the Woods, I was like, Lame is no longer. I had a Stephen Sondheim forever. Just because it's the way he uses language in that show in particular, I think, plays with so many different elements, like especially the fairy tale elements that that are obviously woven into it. But I think like the Agony Reprise, for example, is a great example of what I think excites me so much about Sondheim's work. And then my big 21st birthday present was Finishing the Hat, the book, which is, might be a bit lame, but I just, I desperately wanted to sort of read everything he had to say about lyric writing and music making. And that kind of got me onto every single show of his. I read it front to back, had listened to all the albums as I went along. And since then, I listened to every album probably once a year.
What are your favorites? What are the standouts?
Sunday in the Park with George is my all-time number one, but probably his smaller shows, the ones that I think require a more intimate setting, like Assassins. I love that. I've seen that a couple of times. I really love Pacific Overtures and Passion as well. I mean, they're all great, really, but I think those four are probably the standouts to me. And Merrily as well, actually. I really, really like Merrily. I saw that on stage, the local WAPO, is a WA Academy of Performing Arts, really sort of professional institution, and they put it on. And I thought that was the perfect cast for it, because they were third year music theater students. So just about to enter the industry, but they still had a lot of that youthful energy about them. So I think if we're talking about the casting, about how do you cast Merrily? Do you cast them too young, or do you cast them as pros? That was kind of the perfect nucleus of it. And we saw it in this tiny little round theater in the round, at the university, and it was incredible. I think that really clued me into Merrily, because just reading the text of it, listening to the album, you can't really get a sense of, I guess, the show and the structure of the show, and then seeing it really unlocked a lot of what he was trying to do, or what, you know, the creative team were trying to do with that show. And again, lyrically, it's just so deft.
Because I'm currently going through that show in particular. It is very rich the more you dig into that, and like it's littered throughout that entire score. So it's like a really fascinating show to do that deep dive on.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, now I'm kind of doing this screenwriting stuff from a very linguistic perspective. It's unlocking so many different avenues that I would love to go and see. I would love to go explore in future research. And one of those things is looking at like the function of lyricism, and what each sort of, and how you can use language to develop different things in the score. And how it ties in not only to its own, the song, the music, but also the broader sense of the play, because Sondheim never wrote his own book. So the way he was able to connect everything together and work so seamlessly with his collaborators is exemplary. And I often joke that Sondheim kind of ruined other musicals for me in a way, because nothing's ever as good, which is a shame. But well, that's not true. But a lot of the big shows, I get quite frustrated with them, because they're all about the spectacle, and it's all about the event of going to the theater, which is, it's important, but there's also the other side of it. Like I often will compare them as like the spectacle musicals, and then there's like musicals as an art form, like where they're trying to do something really creative. And I think Adam Gattell does that really well as well. He's another composer lyricist that I really admire.
You know what it's actually ruined for me, and I always have to like push myself away from becoming like a huge snob, but it is like most popular music. When you start listening to it, it's like, oh, that's a slant rhyme. It's like, oh, you like forced the meter to change there when it doesn't really sound proper. But it's like, you know what? That's not the point. It's not the point. It's supposed to be hooky and supposed to be fun to listen to. And I'm totally overanalyzing this.
I mean, I love Come From Away. I watched the Disney Plus thing recently. And I think that is just
talking about a Canadian, Canadian content.
Well, probably the only Canadian musical I think I've ever seen, actually, which is probably...
Well, I always have to remind people, technically, The Drowsy Chaperone is a Canadian musical. That's where it started from, so...
a long tradition of Canadian musicals that come from way of tapping into that.
That's right, that's right.
And that's an incredible show, but I can't help myself and just pick out some of those things where I'm like, well, that's not... And maybe that could have been done a little bit differently, because right, it's not the point, and it's such an affecting show. It's like, well, it doesn't really matter how it's constructed in the end. If you're getting that emotional response from the audience, then
you've won.
This is just so remote.
Into the darkness.
Stars and moonlight.
Upon the thunder.
Nothing but darkness.
Out of the window.
Into the darkness.
Darkness and dreams.
Well, talking about emotional responses, Lady Bird, this is, of course, written and directed by Greta Gerwig. Do you have any like history with Greta Gerwig at all?
I love Greta Gerwig, and I've loved her ever since I saw Frances Ha back.
Mm.
It would have been just very soon after it was released, I think. I would have been in university at the time, just completing my undergrad. And that sort of, it was exactly the sort of films that I wanted to make and the sort of films that I wanted to see. Very empathetic portraits, very low stakes, snippets of time. And I think she does that so well. And obviously that one was directed by Noah Baumbach, but
yes,
greatest fingerprints are all over it, I think. And so I was really interested in sort of following her career after that. I went back and I watched some of her early work. She acted in a film called Hannah Takes the Stairs. Which is directed, I think, by one of the Duplass brothers, or maybe Joe Swalberg, but it was part of that mumblecore sort of scene that she was, that's kind of where she filled her boots early on, or where she, that was her training ground in the mumblecore scene in the mid-2000s. And you can
It is directed by Joe Swanberg, but it has Mark Duplass in it. So yeah. I can see why you would get confused. Just in case, I always have to remember that some people don't know certain terms. Can you just explain mumblecore for people who might not know what that means?
Yeah, mumblecore, it's a style of filmmaking it's very, very independent. And it started in the mid-2000s and sort of petered out, I think, when they all got more successful and had a budget to do things. But mumblecore is a very low-budget filmmaking style where the actors often will improvise on set. They're based on very small snippets of life that focuses on conversations and relationships and turning points that can be quite effective. So the first one I think that's kind of noted as a mumblecore production is a film called Funny Ha Ha by Andrew Bujalski, whose most recent work was Support the Girls. And you can see that evolution there. Support the Girls is, day in the life of a fast food, or not a fast food, I don't know, like a bar, that's a sports bar. In small town America, and focuses on the female employees that work there. That one kind of amps up the plot a little bit more, but mumblecore films are famous for their plotlessness and sort of evoking a sense of tone and emotion, and often very like nostalgic and melancholic atmosphere that they go for. And that was where Greta, so Hannah Takes the Stairs, I think, was Greta's first acting role, maybe first serious acting role, perhaps. And then she made a few more with those guys like Joe Swanberg, who went on to do Easy on Netflix, and the Duplass brothers as well. So, and you can see that, I think, in Frances Ha, it just takes it, you just have a bit more money and you got a little bit more stylization in the filmmaking, and suddenly it's a big hit because, you have a little bit more time and money to play with, and you can explore some of those themes and those tones
Sure. I also think, like, talking about Noah Baumbach, but that's kind of how he started too. I feel like a lot of his early work I would consider in the mumblecore.
Yep.
adjacent. Definitely.
Yeah, Squid and the Whale, I think, is certainly... I think that was probably a more polished production than you get from mumblecore, but the ideas are the same. Right. Sort of like, it's like a bit like navel-gazing a little bit, which I think a lot of people find quite pretentious and boring. But I don't know, there's something about it that just really spoke to me in a really significant way. And it's the sort of films that I like to make. And the sort of films I like to watch, I kind of reject the big plot where everything has to be so significant and every event is like so life-changing. And there's actually a quote of Lady Bird that the Lady Bird says just after her encounter with Kyle, where she's like, not everything has to be war all the time. Things can just be sad.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's how we experience everyday life. They're not big life-changing moments. It's the little things that can be so impactful for us. And I think that's what mumblecore really taps into. And then it's great to see how it's developed into a really sort of distinct style of filmmaking.
Have you seen Nights and Weekends? That's technically Greta Gerwig's first film that she directed.
No, I came across that one yesterday. I've not seen that one, but because he co-wrote and co-directed that one with, who was that with? Was that with Swanberg again?
That sounds right. Let me just talk. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen that one, unfortunately, but I should catch up with it, I think.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, to be honest with you, but I definitely have seen Lady Bird. We watched it again this week before we talked about it. I've seen Her Little Women, which I also was a big fan of. So I'm a pretty big fan of her work. I'm holding out hope that I will enjoy her movie based on Mattel's Barbie, which is coming out in 2023. Like,
I cannot wait for that. I think it's going to be an absolute romp. It's going to be so much fun.
I think so too. My hope, it does do really well, and then she takes that money and then does like a super big passion project with that money. I want it to be successful so she can just like use that blank check to do something like really, really fascinating and interesting, because I've really enjoyed Lady Bird and Little Women. I think it's a very, her voice is this very interesting. I don't really want to get into like the gossip or that sort of thing, but her relationship with Noah Baumbach specifically, it's so fascinating to me that Lady Bird and then his next follow-up, Marriage Story, both have Sondheim references in it. So my hope is that she does a Sondheim project at some point.
There was that rumor that Baumbach was going to make a version of Company with Adam Driver. Yeah. I haven't heard much about that recently, but that would be incredible. What if you could pick one Sondheim for Greta to make a movie of, which would it be?
Honestly, I think the one that comes to me is I think she would be able to nail A Little Night Music just based on her experience now with Little Women, and that because that's so intrinsically a woman's story within A Little Night Music, I think she would have a fascinating take on that material. And sorry to Hal Prince, but that movie version is just not good from the 70s when it came out. So it's a great show that does not have a good version in film form, and I think she'd be able to figure that out.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, because I think she has the respect for his music that I think, but also the understanding of what works in a feature film format to sort of make it, and it's clearly a cinematic story, and so there's no reason it can't work on screen again. And it's a shame that with that the 70s version was a real bust. I think it could be like the great Sondheim movie musical that I don't think we really have outside of West Side and Gypsy, which, you know.
Yeah, plus it's really funny, and I think that for some reason that just gets lost in that 77 version. I don't understand how you lose all the comedy that's so, like, it's part of the text. So you just need someone who can, like, really hit those comedy beats.
Yeah, exactly. I also think she very weirdly do a good Assassins. Not that they will ever get made in America, but I just think she could really nail the sort of humanity of each of those characters. And again, the period stuff. There's so much cinematic material in that show, I think it would just make it fantastic movie, but I just can't see how it ever gets made.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about thinking about an Assassin's adaptation into film. One, how do you do it? I think I've read a few different takes that I think would probably work cinematically. But B, even theater audiences sometimes get mad at that show when they go and see it. So I cannot imagine that going out wide in America. People would lose their minds, I feel.
Not in America. I would love to see like maybe a British production of it, you know, where made in the UK is like released on some streaming service or something, and then Americans and they get outraged. I think that's probably the only way you can do it, because I just can't see how it gets financed. But yeah, you just need a director with, I think, the ability to sort of handle the material in a way that is not sensitive to the text, but like the way that elevates it in the cinematic form. And I think Greta could do it because she's a very creative and very empathetic director, like I said. So, but I think A Little Night Music is probably more likely to happen.
He talks softly of his wars and his horses and his whores. I think love's a dirty business. So do I. I'm before him.
Getting back to Lady Bird, what is Lady Bird about?
Well, I think at its core, Lady Bird is about the relationship between a mother and a daughter in her last year of schooling. So the daughter's Lady Bird in her last year of school. And I think Lady Bird tries to disguise that fact by showing you the life of Lady Bird through school. But at its core, it is about Lady Bird's relationship with her mother, Marion, and the events that lead up to her leaving to go to New York for college, which is ultimately the climax of the film. No spoilers. It's a film about family, a film about maternal love, a film about pseudo-rebellious teenage years that everybody, I think, experiences in the late years of high school. And it's about finding yourself, I think, as well. From Lady Bird's perspective, a lot of what she does is about how she fits into the world and how she doesn't really know she doesn't really know where she's going, and she doesn't get that support from her mum. So it's a beautiful film, but it's quite simple, I think, in its main themes.
Yeah, in particular, that core dynamic between mother and daughter. This is... we'll talk about the other Sondheim connection within this movie, but that does feel like such a dynamic about these two characters that are very particular, who are like just butting heads with one another. Like, it kind of goes back to A Little Night Music in a way, where it's like they're two very individualistic people who do love each other, but there are sometimes conditions placed on that love that each of them is able to give and receive simultaneously. So it's a fascinating character study, and it's really funny. I actually have to say, doing this rewatch, I laughed out loud a few different times. I'd forgotten how good some of like the setups and payoffs are. I don't know, did you rewatch it this week as well?
I rewatched it this week for the first time in about 3 years, I think. So I'd seen it several times after it came out. It holds up, so like it improved in my estimation, and I had already very lofty recollections of the film. I remember loving it so much, just feeling like the portraiture of Lady Bird is so effective and compelling. And then seeing it again, I noticed all of those little funny moments and the little conversations, and everything is so precise. Yeah, it's as you say, it's hella tight. I think it just every little moment works, I think, in the creation of this life that she's telling us. And it really does feel like, I read somewhere that the original script was 350 pages long.
Jesus.
I mean, I could see that version. but I think you can see that world that she's developed in there. And she's just, it's almost like she's just picked out a few of the key moments from that bigger script and put it together to create like almost like a snapshot. It's almost like a collage. I mean, all of the scenes are quite short. I mean, I was trying to think of what the longest scene is, and I think it might be with Kyle at the where she loses her virginity in Kyle's house, because everything else is just these little snapshots. You don't need anything more, because you get the totality of it as it goes along. You're just experiencing life as Lady Bird almost remembers it. I think
this is like right before Timothy Chalamet like really broke out. So see him as like this like supporting character. It also goes with my theory that I think Timothy Chalamet should do more just weird supporting roles, because I think he always nails them. Where he sometimes doesn't, for me at least, as the lead actor. But that's a complete digression. He's the dirtbag boyfriend. He gets to play Kyle, the dirtbag boyfriend.
He nails it. He honestly, that I didn't realize just how pretentious and wanky that character.
Yeah.
and reading it, and because he delivers the lines with such sincerity and such earnestness. Like, I mean, I think we all know that sort of person. But so reading along the script and you read the lines that he's saying, you're like, whoa, this is insane. Like, this is one of the most annoying people you could have ever met. But the way he's such charm and like, you know, he's very alluring, and that comes across, obviously, with his obsession with him, that she kind of eventually realizes that.
That's the key to that character, is that you have to, at least through Lady Bird's eyes, which is a moniker she gives herself. Her name is Christine, but she calls herself Lady Bird. She has to find him alluring at the very beginning, and we, the audience, have to somewhat understand that. But the further that relationship goes on, it's like, you are like the most pretentious, awful person. just a drag to be around. Although he does deliver that line of like, I didn't lie. I haven't lied in 2 years, so I would remember that.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's just so brilliant, because you can just see those sort of people, and they say stuff like that. And they the one that really got me is when he's he only lives by bartering alone, and he doesn't pay for anything because he doesn't want to exist in the capitalist structures. And then Lady Bird says, "But you go to Catholic school, doesn't that cost money?" And it's like, it's just he's a brilliant little side character. And you're right, and I think Timothy nails it, because he's so. I don't know what's the way he's a boy. He's an incredible actor, with that helps, but he just plays it with such seriousness. And he's great, but I think he's really good in Call Me By Your Name, but I don't think Magnetism with June, and it might be the trappings of genre there, but I just didn't.
I think it is. I mean, and I say this as someone who liked the movie Dune, that character, the lead character, is such a cipher for the audience that you can't do a lot of interesting things with it. And I think he gets trapped in that. He gets one opportunity to feel like a real person at the very beginning with Jason Momoa. And then after that, it's just like, I'm dark and I'm brooding. I continue to play dark and brooding. To be fair, it is half the book, so I'll wait until Dune 2 to make that as a final proclamation. But I'm looking forward to this cannibal movie that's coming out, so I'm gonna check that out.
That sounds like an absolute wild ride. I can't wait for that one. But I think his body of work proves that he's like a real star. I mean, he's great in Little Women. Again, like, it's not really the main role. Well, it's not the main role, but it's not quite a side character. But again, he's just playing like a real arsehole. But he does it with such charisma that it sells. And you can absolutely believe why, Saoirse Ronan in both instances falls in love with him.
That's right. if people are listening and are still like, but why are we talking about this in relation to Stephen Sondheim? So why are we talking about this in relation to Stephen Sondheim?
Well, the full musical that the Lady Bird School, in collaboration, which goes to an all-girls school, in collaboration with the all-boys school, the musical that the school puts on is Merrily We Roll Along. Which is an insane choice.
Which I just find infinitely funny that that is the musical that they put on.
It's so bizarre. I mean, it works perfectly for the film, but it makes no sense for a school to put it on. I stand by that.
Okay, Christine.
Lady Bird.
Take it away, Lady Bird.
Everybody says don't, everybody says don't, everybody says don't, it isn't right, don't, it isn't nice. Everybody says don't, everybody says don't, everybody says don't walk on the grass, rolling along.
Channel of your peace, where there's despair in life, let me bring hope. Where there is darkness, only light. And where there's sadness, ever joy.
There are giants in the sky. There are big, tall, terrible giants in the sky. When you're way up high and you look below at the world you left and the things you know, little more than a glance is enough to show you.
They put on Merrily We Roll Along, and Lady Bird and her best friend Julie both audition. And Julie's given the part of Mary, which is fantastic because it means that she gets to be romantic with the first love interest of the film, Danny, who is cast. Mm-hmm. And Lady Bird, unfortunately, she only gets a part in the chorus, so it doesn't have that much to do. But
which, by the way, can I just say how bonkers it is that this movie called a shot that had not actually happened yet, which is Beanie Feldstein playing Mary before she was cast as being Mary and Merrily We Roll Along the movie.
Do you think that Linklater saw this and was like, that's my Mary? That's a
maybe. It's like, that has to be Mary. I don't know. It's so weird.
In the little snippet of old friends that you see, I'm like, I buy it. I can see it. I can see
yeah.
it. In 20 years' time, I cannot wait for that.
But yeah, so they're putting on Merrily We Roll Along, and you do... Yeah, I hear like old friends. You hear the Merrily We Roll Along song, reprise and transitions. I feel there's another song that you actually... Oh, Our Time. You actually hear Our Time very briefly too, before the curtain call. So you hear a few snippets of that song throughout. And I do love the payoff for all of this is that the Stephen McKinley Henderson, the actor who's there, who decides he wants to put on Merrily We Roll Along. I love him sitting in the lobby as people leave and they didn't get it.
It breaks my heart.
Yeah.
Because it's like, and then he maybe retires or is fired straight after that.
Mm-hmm.
I just see the parallels with Sondheim. And he looks a little bit like Sondheim in his old age, Stephen McKinley.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting down there, slumped in his chair. They didn't understand it. Oh, it's been heartbreaking. And then he goes to leave his career exactly like Sondheim did. And so you just need to change. Mm-hmm. To bring him back into the
that's right.
Yeah,
we need a spin-off that follows Father
Levine.
Whatever his last name is, I don't remember what it is, but
I'd watch him just directing different Sondheim musicals. His high schools.
I love that him going to schools. Okay, we're gonna do Passion. All right, we're gonna do Passion as the fall musical. You know, on this rewatch, what I really noticed was that there actually is, I feel, some more parallels to Merrily than what I even kind of understood when I first watched this a few years ago. I think it's partly because I've been doing the deep dive and have a deeper relationship with Merrily now. But the biggest one is that our main character, Lady Bird, is not content with the present. She's constantly looking to the future. It's like, I want to leave Sacramento. I want to be in New York. I want to be this thing. I want to have this success. And at the expense, she almost loses herself, like Frank, pushes away her friends, pushes away her family in full commitment to get this goal that she wants. But unlike Merrily, she learns her lesson before it's too late, is what I feel like the true thing is. But I don't know if you agree or not.
No, I absolutely agree. I think it's very purposeful that Greta picked this particular one. Not that it would really make sense unless you know Merrily, but I think it really, it deepens the story to sort of find those parallels between it. It's absolutely about dreams and wanting to be better than where you are at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think probably Merrily is maybe a bit different because there's that sense of expectation and hope. And I think that's probably why Lady Bird kind of feels that frustration, because she doesn't have anything to look forward to. She's not particularly talented in any way, shape, or form. Bad at math. I mean, everybody laughs at her when she wants to go to one of those big universities. But I think it speaks to like the experience of teenagers that you're always wanting to be better than you are, especially like, I mean, aggressively mediocre people like Lady Bird is. She mm-hmm. wants to find something that's at the moment not accessible to her, and she just can't find those avenues. And I think that's probably a little bit different to Merrily Roll On, because they're so talented and clearly going to be successful, as we know, because we watch it from the backwards going to the naivety. But it's like I said before, I think you're starting that phase of naivety, because there's the world of opportunity that she has in front of her. She just has to keep herself grounded. And I think you're right. At the end of the movie, she does kind of get that closure with her relationship with her, certainly with Julie, and a little bit with her mom. I mean, they never really meet on screen, which I think is a real intentional tragedy that the final note to her mom happens over a phone call.
I think that's the biggest thing. Like early on in the film, she states straight up, like, I hate being alone. And you can kind of see that she's constantly trying to fill herself with like new best friends, new boyfriends, different people. It's not really until the very end where she does consciously be by herself that she kind of comes to that realization, like, yeah. Oh, okay. And you also get that wonderful scene with Laurie Metcalf in the car circling the airport, which how she lost the Oscar, I'll be mad about that for years and years. Because she kind of just nails that performance. Both of those characters come to realizations when they're alone, which is, I think, kind of a fascinating connection between those two characters.
Yeah, and I think that, again, it's like, I think it speaks to the care that Greta Gerwig has for these characters, is that they can't really, I mean, their relationship is so tense whenever they're together, but you can mm-hmm. see the love that they have for each other. I think that you never really lose the sense that one or the other doesn't love the other person. And there's that scene where Lady Bird says, but do you like me? I think that's probably
right. You love me, but do you like me?
And I think that's the struggle that Mary, the mum, has. And she doesn't realize that they're different things until she's circling the airport, and there's a sense of loss. And I think that you're right. I mean, it's tragic that those things happen when they're alone and that they can't. And you get the sense that whenever they go and see each other, they're going to resume their sort of very toxic relationship that they have with one another, because they don't have the words to express that in person, I think. And that's probably why it is quite appropriate that the final thing happens on a phone message.
Yeah, I mean, this is why it's such an interesting look, I guess, at how you fundamentally are a different person when you hang out with the other people, right? You're a different person when you're with your family, or a different person when you're with, like, in a relationship. You're a different person with your friends. You are still the same person. That's what the weirdness is, I think, of humanity. I think that is so clear when Lady Bird is talking with her brother's girlfriend, and the girlfriend says, like, your mother's very warm and open, like, she's such a kind person. It's like, no, she's not, like, because yep. Lady Bird doesn't see that side of her very often. But for other people, she's a nurse, she's like so open-hearted, she gives gifts to her staff. Like, we see actually the evidence that it's probably true that she is very open and kind to other people, but not with her daughter. And her first boyfriend, he even says, like, she's scary. She's intense. So different people at different times.
Yeah. And I think the same holds true for Lady Bird as well. And it's all about exploring the different aspects of her identity as she sort of, you know, starts. Well, when she dates the two different boys, you can clearly see that she's like, how am I with this person? How am I with this person? Do I like this side of me? When she's hanging out with this popular girl, I think her name's Jenna. You know, that's a different side of her that she's exploring. And then she comes to the realization that she can just be herself, and that is enough. And I mean, that scene when they're trying on the dresses for prom, and she says, what if this is the best version of me?
Right.
Again, just heartbreaking at the time, because you think, well, and that's enough. And you really want, you're longing for Marion to be maternal there and bring her into a hug and say, you're enough, whatever. But she just can't find that.
She can't.
And I think that's what makes her such an interesting character, and what Laurie Metcalf does really well. And I agree, absolutely robbed at the Oscars that year. Well, I shouldn't say that because I can't remember who won, but presumably she was the best performer that year. Because that you never feel like angry towards Marion. I don't think you never really feel contempt that she's not doing enough, because she's got such a humanity in those other parts of her. And I think that goes to the fact that you would expect that Lady Bird is the sole protagonist of this, and that every scene probably has Lady Bird in it. But there's actually quite a few scenes that just have the mom, and almost all of them, as you say, are showing a very tender, very caring side of her, part that sort of, there's actually a line in the script where early in the film, she's driving home from work, as a nurse, and I will find it here. So Marion drives back home. It is romantic somehow. She loves these streets, loves the turns she knows so well. When she's not resenting the stuckness of her own life, she has an enormous capacity to love it. And then in bold, remember this moment with Marion. And I think that was a very, because, you know, it's a throwaway scene in the film, you know, it's almost like a transition. It just goes from one place to the other, which is listening to her music as she drives past, and there's like a little flutter of emotion on her face. And then when she gets home, she slams the door and the music stops and she's back to her regular life. But that parallel with that moment and then the driving around the airport, I think that really, it just forms a nice connection, really ties the character of Marion together.
Well, I wonder how much of that somewhat division is like how outwardly Lady Bird mentions she hates Sacramento, like how much she just hates Sacramento, but her mother loves it. Like she does have an affection for the place that she lives in. Again, going back to that phone call that's so pivotal at the end, is like, I've got to tell you, Mom, like I got my license finally to drive and I drove my first time in Sacramento and I got it. Like I understood why you like this place so much. The nun points that out. It's like, you must love Sacramento. It's like, no, I don't. I hate it. It's like, well, you very lovingly write about it. It's like, oh, well, I notice things. Or she observes things, is what she says.
I think she says pays attention.
Pays attention. She pays attention to things, right? And then she says, isn't love and attention the same thing?
Yeah.
It's a very great line. This movie is filled with great lines, I think.
I think you can take, there's so many good quotes that I think work in isolation as like sort of mottos for life or something, like, you know, that you can just apply to something. And that was another thing that I actually wanted to mention about this film is that it's so Sacramento. It's like, it represents Sacramento. I've never been to Sacramento, but I feel like I know what that place is about. And I think coming of age films do that uniquely well, are able to tie to place because, you know, when you are growing in maybe a small town, I mean, I'm from Perth on the west coast of Australia, which is famously the most isolated city in the world. And we have that same tension between like staying and going and wanting to spread your wings and go somewhere else that's more meaningful, more impactful. But I think what you see again and again is that people come back to Perth because it's home, and the place that you resented for being so small and closed off eventually has that sort of sense of security that ties into like notions of family and nostalgia and all of that sort of stuff. And coming of age films are connected to place more so than any other genre. And I think that's why I love them, because you can sort of, you get an understanding of what it's like to be a teenager in all these places, and the themes are the same in coming of age. They're quite often about identity and finding yourself and working your way through the world. But to do that in a specific place just makes it feel so much more rich. I think one of my favorite films is a Swedish movie. It has a curse in the title, so I'll say it anyway. It's called Fight Amal. Show Me Love. It was also called in global release because I didn't want to have the word fuck in the title. And it's one of my favorite films. It's by a Swedish director called Lucas Moodysson. And it's so grainy. It's got one of the worst cinematography you'll ever see. But it's heartfelt. It's this tiny little Swedish place called Amal. And it's in there in the title. And it's exactly the same thing of like, this struggle between young people stuck in a place that they feel that they have to get out of, but then finding the connection through place and through relationships that kind of ties it all together, which is a very rambly way of saying that I love that this is so specifically Sacramento, and I don't think it could work in any other place because it's tied to that city and tied to Greta's own experiences that way.
Yeah. Before we get too far away, the person who did win that year for Best Supporting Actress was Allison Janney from I, Tonya, which is a movie that I enjoy. I just think that Laurie Metcalf did a much better performance.
But I think she's doing more. I mean, Allison Janney's, that's a great movie and a great performance, but it's very, it's a real character role, and you can really play those beats quite strongly. But I think the humanity that Laurie Metcalf brings to a very tough role. Yeah, superb acting. And she hasn't really done much since then, has she? I've been maybe on...
Not a whole lot, no. The other big connection that I saw between this movie and Merrily, you know, outside them performing it for their school play, is that there is a scene, it's essentially, you know, Lady Bird has lost her virginity, she's now in the bathroom, her mother has to come in and use the washroom, so putting like lotion or something on her face, the mother is, and Lady Bird's sitting on the toilet, and they start talking about success specifically, because the dad is losing his job, and it's all this other stuff is going on. But the mother, William Metcalf does mention the fact that, like, listen, success doesn't mean that you're happy. It just means that you're successful. I think, again, it's just like interesting truism that just kind of gets thrown out there. And is a very, again, great motherly advice. And it's like, hey, don't chase just success. You have to also try and be happy at the same time, which, you know, through all their problems, like, you can't say that the parental unit, I guess, doesn't love each other in this film. Definitely going through some hard times, but it's not like, I feel like another filmmaker might be, the impulse would be for them to be fighting all the time as well. And that really is not happening in this movie. They do feel like they're a team trying to figure it out.
Yeah, and I really respect that about this movie, is that it's quite a unique family dynamic that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And one that I can't think is, that I can't think of in another film where, you know, the tension is clearly between the mother and the daughter, but she has such a good relationship with her dad, you know, who's the
right.
And some of their conversations around, you can't always be the nice guy. And I think the mum really takes on that role of being the bad cop.
Yes.
In several instances, but they've clearly found their niche in that dynamic. And just the way that Lady Bird talks to her dad compared to how she talks to her mum says a lot about, I think, the unspoken nature of their relationships that, you know, throughout childhood. And going back to that quote about success, you know, it doesn't mean that you're happy. The irony of that is that, as Lady Bird says, but dad's not happy because he's on antidepressants as well. So he's not successful and he's not happy.
Right.
So I think that's just an instance of Marion just thinks, you know, she wants to say, like, you know, she wants to reassure Lady Bird, but doesn't really quite have the right words to say, because I think she herself is quite scared about the situation that they're in. I mean, and she's got to be the thing that ties the family together. I think she does that. And that's her role in the family unit, is the steadfast, working double shifts, you know, being the hard ass that, like, has to get everything mm-hmm. time and done. I mean, the connections to Merrily, I think, are quite clear to me in the idea of, like, the outside of the, like, sort of, what am I trying? I have a quote here that I was going to get mm-hmm. up from.
Sure.
From Greta. Mine is taking me a little bit of time to find it, sorry.
While you're finding that, like, a review that I found on Letterboxd from Matt Singer, who I normally like his writing style, but it's very short. And I thought his outlook was so fascinating, which is like, so Lady Bird is two names, two boyfriends, two best friends, two semesters, two school plays, two dances, two parties, two distinct relationships with her parents, two potential colleges, two churches, and I'm 100 million kajillion tears for the scene at the airport, which is true. But I do think that it is paired very nicely. Like, there's two halves. There's two, like they said, two boyfriends, two relationships with her parents, two best friends that they explore with it. Like, her trying to chase fame and popularity, realizing that that's not what she wants to do. It really is broken out into twos throughout this entire movie. And until I read them, like, oh, you're right. Yeah, there's a lot of this and that, or this or that. And it's her trying to figure out which one to choose.
Yeah, and I think it's to Greta's credit that it's not obvious that the film is broken up into that duality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think probably the clearest one is the two boyfriends, and you kind of notice that.
Yeah.
I think the fact that Danny continues to have a presence throughout the film,
yes,
and sort of discarded and thrown away, I think it gives it that sense of realism and naturalism, because the people don't just come into your life and then leave again. He does a really good job of threading every. I mean, Kyle appears earlier on. When she's still dating Danny, when he's playing the bass guitar at the cafe,
mm-hmm.
and is, you know, she doesn't just appear when she's useful to the story. It feels very lived in, and so yeah, she disguises that very well. But I think it is that nature of either yes or that, or, you know, like that quote from any moment mm-hmm. in the book. Why can't I have both? Well, because that's not how life works, unfortunately.
That's right. I mean, and that's also, I always like that scene too with Lucas Hedges, her first boyfriend, who is revealed to be gay pretty early on into the movie. And when he comes and sees her at work there, like, at first she is very cold and distant and like mad. And then he breaks down, like, I don't know how I'm going to tell my parents about this. And then she totally flips and is like, I'm going to console this person. And that's where, again, this is kind of great writing, is you can totally buy, like, oh, you were just like your mom in a way, which is like, you can flip if you need to.
Yep.
To be consulting in this relationship, at least. Again, we'll see if Lady Bird ever has a daughter of her own, if she can be as open-hearted as she wants that to be.
Yeah, it's that scene's another one. I mean, this scene's just, the movie's filled with just like little moments that absolutely break your heart. And that's one of them, because she plays it, well, Lucas is a great actor as well. And
yeah.
he plays it with real honesty. And And that flip, I think, it's key to the film of sort of getting other people's perspectives, and you never really know what's going on in someone else's head. So before that, Lady Burgess feels betrayed, right? Been cheated on, basically, with a man. And of course, she's hurt and angry. But as soon as she sort of is let in a little bit to him, she realizes it's not just about herself, and that there's other things going on. And yeah, she was treated poorly. I don't think we should necessarily ignore that art.
Yeah, just gloss over that. Yeah.
But that empathy, I think, is really important and a key part to the film of people have their inner lives that you can't just discount in pursuit of your own. And Lady Bird does feel that she pays the price for that with her friend Julie, where she kind of doesn't treat her very well. And this sort of main character syndrome that Lady Bird has, and then Julie, the best friend, calls out in that scene in the car park, I think that kind of catches up with her. And I think that is another parallel to Merrily Again with Franklin Shepard, who does go on his own path, and he's always got to be the center of attention. It's all about Frank. And so he ignores Mary and he ignores Charlie unless he needs them to be in his life. And I think that is a lesson that Lady Bird learns.
Bending with the road, gliding through the countryside.
Merrily we roll along, catching at dreams.
Dreams that will explode,
waking up the countryside.
Everybody merrily,
merrily, sing 'em your song. Rolling along.
You know what I always love? Because it's so... it's both comedic and so tragically true, at least I guess I'm just speaking for me, is when she does kind of reunite with Beanie Feldstein, her friend, and Beanie's like, maybe I'm just not meant to be or I'm not built to be happy. Right? It's like, you're sad all the time. It's like, I don't think I'm built to be a happy person. And she's fine with it. That's the thing, is she's embraced it. It's like, yeah, I'm just sad sometimes, and I deal with it.
Their relationship is another really interesting and really well presented relationship. Because Julie is the sidekick to Lady Bird, basically, for most of it. And then when she gets the role of Mary, and Lady Bird's like, yeah, but I put in effort. Like, this should be, that's for me. And she can't, like, fathom that someone, like, the sidekick in her life has supplanted her in this, because that's not the way her life is meant to go. And so I think that's just another, like, the thread with Julie as it goes in is really key, I think, again, with that perspective.
Sorry, there was a quote you wanted to read.
Yeah. So Sondheim is so witty. This is a quote from Greta. Sondheim is so witty and hilarious and can write, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, and they can also write Losing My Mind. She adds, I think that balance of joy and ache is something that Sondheim is so good at capturing and something that I wanted Lady Bird to have. I hope it feels hilarious and heartbreaking in the same way.
I agree. I think that's a key to why I think I like this, and why I think that people who are into Sondheim should definitely check out this movie if you haven't somehow missed it or have not watched it before. Because besides the Merrily allusions and like similarities, I think it feels like a Sondheim piece in many ways.
Absolutely. And there's a line of dialogue. I think you can tell that she mentions in another interview that like Sondheim is her favorite artist of all time, like with everything. And I think you can see that in the way that she writes the dialogue. There was something that felt so company in an interaction between when Danny comes to the house for the first time and she opens the door. And here we go. So Marion opens the door and lets in Danny, and Marion says, "Hello, Danny, the famous Danny. Aren't you adorable? Larry, isn't he adorable?" And then Larry says, "Adorable." And I was like, "Oh my God, that's like straight from Company." I think the rhythm's really well of that kind of, you know, reflecting middle class life back in the audience. She just sort of gets kind of absurdity in that rhythm. And I think that you can definitely see influenced by him in that way, or by, well, George Firth in that instance, but by the work of Sondheim, definitely.
Maybe she'll adapt Company. Who knows?
I wish. And the other thing, so she was worried that she wouldn't get the rights to do Merrily. So she says, "I never did Merrily in high school because it'd be completely odd for a high school to do. It's about where you end up and where you're from, how they're connected and how they're also so different. And it feels like that the musical answered something to me. And the songs in the middle, you know, Yesterday Is Gone, The Pretty Countryside, Dreams Don't Die, So Keep an Eye on Your Dreams, Before You Know Where They Are, There You Are." And she said, "That felt to me like the songs and those lyrics spread so deeply to what I was trying to capture that it just seemed perfect to me." And she got the rights because Scott Rudin, who, you know, wasn't working much anymore, but he to make the film as well. And he also knew Sondheim. So Greta wrote a little letter to Sondheim talking about how much it would mean to her to have the musical in the film, and Scott Rudin sort of passed it on, and it worked, and that's how she got the rights. So and she had a lot of popular music as well, like Alanis Morissette and Dave Matthews and all of
yes.
that. And apparently she wrote letters to all of them asking about what it means, like what that music meant to her. And I think, you know, artists are more likely to, you know, I think you miss that in a lot of big productions, that sort of sensitivity to the material. And it's like, oh, we're going to use songs as popular and catchy, but it actually means something to the artist and to the piece itself. I think the people are more likely to let their music.
Yeah, I have to say, I was just recently at my city's International Film Festival, and I went and watched some of the talkbacks after certain films that I had watched, and there was this independent film that was made in Quebec, and the filmmakers were there, and the film was actually full of a lot of like popular hits from the 80s and early 90s. So one of the people asked, like, how did you do this? Because they'd reveal what their budget was. Like, it was not much money. It's like, so how did you get the rights to this? And they're like, honestly, we wrote to the artists. And a lot of times, if you just say it would be very meaningful, they'll either waive their huge fees, or they'll do it like, give us like, whatever, $5, and we'll just like sign the contract and it's fine.
Of course, artists want their work to be widely seen and heard and give it another life. There's no reason why they win a lot of the time, and I think sometimes always being very generous with letting his work be seen by as many people as possible. So there's a line in the script again. So this is just as they're putting on the show. Show is about to begin, yada yada, and then she says, "Merrily Roll Along is actually a pretty upsetting and adult show. Julie sings the song about divorce. The other girl, Diana, plays a character who has an affair. There's lots of pretend drinking of alcohol. They dance and sing their hearts out."
That's so funny.
Because it is. It's a very upsetting and adult show, isn't it?
Well, that's what I mean. I just think it's hilarious to think about a high school putting this production on, especially a Catholic high school. And then secondarily to that, you can even see the faces of the crowd. They're like, what is happening? Like, what is going on? Which leads to, of course, the button of like, they didn't get it.
Yeah. I love that. It breaks my heart even thinking about that.
Before we wrap up, any final thoughts on Lady Bird?
Well, I think we should probably mention the audition songs as well.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. Because Lady Bird auditions with an Anyone Can Whistle song, which I think is pretty fun.
I just like, what's the process around Lady Bird hearing that album for the first time and then deciding to sing Everybody Says Don't, a song written for a male singer?
That's right.
And it's not the most lyrical song. And to be fair, she doesn't have a good voice. It is not well sung.
Right.
I can understand why she only got the chorus. Absolutely wild that a high school kid is going to sing Everybody Says Don't.
I know, it's bizarre. A bad audition song, too, for Merrily. Anyways, that's beside the point. And then Lucas Hedges sings Giants in the Sky from Into the Woods. And then I'm forgetting what Beanie auditions with. It's not a Sondheim song, so it's...
Not a Sondheim song. So it's, she's making a channel of your piece.
Yes.
With no backing. So I think the idea was that she hadn't prepared anything. So everybody who maybe task was, you have to sing a Sondheim song for the audition, and Beanie Feldstein doesn't know any, so she has to sing like a Christian song that she probably heard of. And the Giants in the Sky one is perfect for Dan Easley. I mean, it ties into a lot of the themes as well. I think you hear a snippet of Being Alive, just the very last little bit of it.
That's right. Yeah.
And then they also sing the title track in the car on Thanksgiving when they go to the bar, and so it's such a joyous scene. I mean, I've been in like, situations where you just sing Sondheim with a bunch of friends, and honestly, it's some of the highest points of my life when everybody singing along to Our Time or something.
Yeah.
I think it's that great expression of friendship that I think Merrily also captures very well. It's a really beautiful film, and I think it's one that has entered the canon pretty clearly. I think it's established itself as a real defining movie in Greta Gerwig's career, but also in the pantheon of coming of age films. And I think it's shifting, or it's signifying that shift where Bildungsroman, to use the very wanky literary term, was the domain of male protagonists. And I think what we're seeing now with Lady Bird and also Eighth Grade as well, which I think is another really stunning film, is the shift to showing that from the female perspective and the female gaze. So I think it's a real landmark film for me, certainly. And I also think in the broader cinematic landscape, it speaks to Greta's experience. It's almost like it's also the end of the trilogy, I think, an unofficial trilogy with Frances Ha, then Mistress America in the middle, and then Lady Bird. It's almost like a reverse chronology there. And I think that was a real expression for Greta Gerwig to make that film, which is I guess, semi-autobiographical in a way. I think if you haven't seen it, watch it, because you won't regret it. It's also short. It's only about 90 minutes long, which I didn't
know. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, too. I was like, I honestly, in my mind, thought it was like a two-hour, maybe just over two-hour movie. It's like, no, it's pretty short. It's a 90-minute film.
Very brisk.
I remember, I think, watching an interview with Greta Gerwig about how there was this short period of time in her life. I'm sure it felt longer for her, but like the short period of time in her life where she felt like she was just like treading water. She wasn't progressing in her career. And then someone encouraged her to direct. She's like, I don't know if I can do that. Do people even want to see movies made by me? And she was going to go onto a sitcom. I forget what sitcom it was now. Anyways, it didn't get picked up. And then that's when she kind of veered off and tried to make these films that mattered to her. And it like this kind of blew up her career. So I think it's one of those things that even Sondheim talks about like, I'd rather fail at something that I'm passionate about than fail at something that I don't care about.
Yeah, absolutely. And regrettably, I do remember what the sitcom was. It was How I Met Your Dad.
That's what it was. I knew it was a spinoff of something. Yeah.
Which is now being made with Hilary Duff. But I'm so glad that she didn't get locked into that role and she was able to make these films, because I think she's suited to directing. She's got a great eye, I think, and she knows what's going to work visually. I mean, the incredible thing about this shooting script that I have been referencing is that it's pretty much, and I'm sure it's a pre-production, because there are some things that don't quite fit, but it's pretty much translated directly into the final film. So I think she just had a very clear idea of what this story was and how she wanted to tell it. And I think that's what makes it such a beautiful film.
If people wanted to, you know, stay in contact with you, see what you're up to, what's the easiest way for them to do so online?
I probably on Twitter, not that I post very much, and it's very niche content about the sports team that I follow in Australia, but you can catch me there at Sam Herriman, SamHerriman, same handle on Instagram. And I also run an alternate Instagram account called Scenic Benches, where I document all types of benches in the world in weird and wonderful places. So give that a follow if you like niche bench content.
You don't know that, but like the Venn diagram of Sondheim fan and bench enthusiast is basically a perfect circle.
Exactly.
So
that's what I'm trying to tap into there.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Cheers.